Today's podcast is sponsored by Richard's Coffee Shop, located in Mooresville, North Carolina. Thank you guys for all your support and what you do for veterans. Today's podcast, we have Anthony Stephen Malone. He's a, I'm just now getting to learn him, getting to learn his background and what he done in the military. Anthony, if you want to go over where you kind of grew up, what intrigued you to join the military for the people listening?
Yeah, Alan, thank you for having me on your podcast. And thank you for your service and for all the work that you do in helping support the veterans as well. That's so important. Yes, sir. But obviously, full name, Anthony Stephen Malone, former member of the British Parachute Regiment. I joined the British military when I was 17. I'm a fifth generation soldier. So my father, my grandfather, my grandfather, my uncles, my cousins, all of us were in the services. And the in our family, we take it isn't just a job, it's a responsibility to be able to serve Queen and country. And now obviously the military serves King and country. I joined the military because I come from the northeast of England. There's not a lot up there job-wise at that time. This was back in 1988. So I served with 4 Power, which is a TA battalion. Then I went into 3 Power, A Company, which is the regulars. I was fortunate enough to be able to do an operational tour of Northern Ireland. I also done tours of Cyprus and Kenya. Then after that, I thought I would leave the military, and like a lot of army guys, I went into the private security work. I cut my teeth in that across Africa, South Africa, East Africa, and West Africa. Ended up in Cyprus. Then I started to do some photography, because I was bodyguarding some cameramen and journalists, and I learned a lot from these cameramen and journalists, and I actually ended up being a combat photographer myself. Then I ended up in Iraq 2002 as an embedded combat photographer with 101st Airborne Division. That the general in charge at that time was David Petraeus, who now everyone knows he went on to be in charge of Central Command, and is a former director of the Central Intelligence Agency. While I was in Iraq at this time, I was out on the ground a lot, so I was able to pass some information back to American intelligence. I'll give that a broad stroke. And some of that information and intelligence led to saving the lives of American and British servicemen. Then my career took a bit of an unusual turn, and I ended up in Afghanistan.
Oh, wow.
And that's kind of condensed.
Yeah, if you want to, it says you were a bodyguard. Like, what does that entail of?
I was quite fortunate, actually, because when I was younger, I managed to do a course with Task International, which back in the day, they were doing a lot. I think they still do a lot of bodyguard work, bodyguard courses all over the world. So I was trained by Task, and then I ended up going on the private within the private security industry, and I was the personal bodyguard to celebrities and VIPs and prominent people, including people from this Saudi families as well, and international businessmen throughout the United Kingdom, Europe, and obviously the Middle East.
Was that pretty intense or kind of laid back job?
I found it quite laid back, because I was fortunate enough to have some incredible clients who turned out to be my lifelong friends as well. I shy away from doing a lot of the celebrity security. I don't really like to do that, because celebrities generally want to be seen by the paparazzi. I prefer to work with clients who don't want to be seen, who like a very low-key security. It was intense at times, because I was fortunate enough to travel all over the world with some of these clients, and I ended up actually running the security and being a advisor to a lot of these international businessmen who were gathered over the years.
So when you got to Iraq, that was in 2002.
Yep, I ended up being an embedded combat photographer, 2002, 101st Airborne.
So that was right before the invasion, correct?
That was during the invasion. I went into Iraq as a freelance, then ended up getting an embed because I spent that much time in country. I was actually offered an embed while I was in country, which is quite unusual.
Can you go into a little bit of it, and so people that don't really know what you're doing, explain kind of like your everyday, day-to-day job?
It was actually one of the most interesting parts of what I would say of my career, because obviously I'm a soldier, so I was able to use a lot of my experience and soldiering skills as a combat photographer. So I gave up carrying a weapon and ended up carrying a camera, and I was able to document the actual war, 101st Airborne during combat operations and on patrol. And I was literally allowed to go anywhere and everywhere. So I spent time with the Pathfinders, 101st. Then I also spent time with American Special Forces. Because they knew I was a former British paratrooper, I think that helped a lot. So I didn't have to be taught any like basics, for want of a better word. And it ended up that I made some lifelong friends there in 101st Airborne, who have went on to be brigadier generals and colonels themselves as well.
Wow, that's interesting. How long were you there in Iraq?
Around 3 years on and off.
Wow.
Yeah,
That's a long
I
time.
think at one point I was the longest serving combat photographer. Because I was actually there when rotations of the military went out, came in again. I did take a 2 week break, and I spent that doing a road trip around Kurdistan, which is northern Iraq.
Yeah, I was there in 05, so you probably was there when I was there.
Yeah, I was on and off there a lot.
Yeah, I was in Tikrit, which was Saddam's hometown, and 05 is when all the IEDs and roadside bombs and everything were pretty high.
Yeah, it started to go very, it got very hostile around 2005, 2006. So the job on the ground was real. There was a real threat there. And if my memory serves me correct, British and American casualties were pretty much at the highest over that period of time as well.
Oh yeah, it was seemed like every other day we were losing somebody or somebody getting messed up by IEDs and stuff. So now, did you have like a kit, or would you just like a body armor helmet and stuff, or would you just did they supply that, or do you have to get it yourself?
It was a mixture of a lot of things because I spent a lot of time on the ground. I generally gun native, so I wear the local drab. So when I was in the military base, obviously I dressed like a Westerner. When I was out on the actual ground, most of the time I dressed in local because we had unusual access. And I was able to cross the border at that time, in 2002, 2003, from Syria to Iraq as well. So we were able to gain a lot of trust from the locals, and we were able to gain a lot of information there as well.
Oh, that's awesome. What was your most scariest time while doing that job?
There was a few times that were very hairy, but the one that there's actually a few that will always stick in my mind. One of them was when we attended an execution site tight in a house in Mosul. A local family who had been working with the Americans had been executed by basically Al-Qaeda. And I went in there with the military police who were attached to 101st at that time. And I actually took the photographs to be used as forensics. I've seen a lot of dead bodies. A lot of the guys who were listening, we've been to war, we've seen it. You know what I mean? That one, though, it was difficult to go in there and to do that particular job. It was an important job, so I went in and did it. But children had been executed as well in that particular room. And the bodies had been on the actual floor there for a few days. And there was about an inch or more of body fluid all over the room. This place, it looked like a horror film. So I would say that was most probably one of the most difficult things. But it was an important one because those photographs were actually used to help identify the people responsible. And a lot of my photographs from Iraq have been used in war crimes investigations as well.
Wow. And that's the thing people don't understand. Once you see that, it never goes away. Never.
Yeah, it's very difficult to process, but I try to not block it off. You've always got to remember this stuff because I find if you block it off or you don't talk about it, it comes out in other ways. And I know a lot of veterans who are listening and watching it will understand that as well.
Yeah, it took me a while to reach out to talk about some things, and there's still things I won't talk about. But it's irrelevant to, it's just something that I always keep in the back of my mind. I probably should talk about it, but I don't know. What was the most rewarding part of that job?
The most rewarding part was seeing the professionalism of having the honor to be able to work with 101st Airborne. Incredible guys, incredible soldiers. And because obviously I'm a fellow brother in arms, it was like being with family. Very difficult for anyone to explain that. A lot of these, when I went in there, I'd only met a couple of them in the past. But when, after being there for such a long period of time, it was actually classed as family. Michael Lennington, who ended up being Brigadier General Michael Lennington, still refers to me as his blood brother as well, because we spent time on the ground there in Iraq at that time.
Oh, that's awesome. I got some photos I want you to, I'm going to put up, and then if you want to explain them, kind of go over them and explain what's going on in them photos.
This is quite a recent photograph. This was taken in Afghanistan during the evacuation. I went back into Afghanistan as a veteran on a self-funded humanitarian mission, Operation Patriot, and we were able to move over 400 people, families, vulnerable children, through Taliban checkpoints to safety. This particular picture is actually taken outside of the British Embassy.
Okay. I kind of want to come back to that one because, you know, that was a big, big kind of a deal. Is this probably the same thing?
This was, I was having tea basically with a senior member of the Taliban in Kabul. That gentleman was the head of protocol at the presidential palace, where I also got invited, and I had a meeting at the presidential palace with the Taliban as well.
Oh, wow.
This was taken at the roughly about the same time as that. Obviously, the situation in Afghanistan is quite hostile. You've got ISIS-K, you've got Al-Qaeda and other extremist elements there. So we obviously take our personal security, and when we're in a building or we're traveling, sometimes you've got to be able to protect yourself out there.
Oh, 100%. We'll come back to that one. We'll come back to
This
that
is,
one.
right. This is the front cover of my new book, Honor Bound, part three. It's part of the Honor Bound trilogy. Then I've written about my experiences in Iraq, Afghanistan. This particular part three is about Afghanistan. It's about a little bit of it is about me, but I've written more about women's rights, the security situation on the ground. And I do a lot of, I'm a special advisor to friendly governments and agencies. So I advise them on counterterrorism.
Oh, wow. That's really cool.
This was taken a long time ago. That was 2010, I believe. That's when I was working undercover for American intelligence, Polishaki prison, Afghanistan. I spent 3 years undercover infiltrating the Haqqani network and Taliban.
Oh, wow.
This is an interesting one. When I got back from Afghanistan about 5 months ago, 6 months ago, I found out I'd actually been shortlisted for the English Veteran Awards. So I was shortlisted for the Inspiration of the Year Award and Lifetime Achievement Award for the work that I've done and the work I've done to, helping veterans, homeless military veterans, both in the United Kingdom and across America.
Wow, that's really cool. Congratulations. Okay, so you spent, what did you say, a little over 3 years in Iraq?
Yeah.
So once that duty was over, did you go back home, or what did you have going on in between your
deployment? I was always hopscotching. It turned out, and it wasn't meant to be the way it worked out. I was passing information on to American intelligence because I had unusual access, and I'd built a rapport with a lot of people. A lot of the local sheikhs and government officials in Iraq and in Syria. I ended up hopscotching between Iraq, Syria, Saudi Arabia, Lebanon, and Afghanistan. And then I started to really specialize. I wanted to get into the mindset. I wanted to understand the enemy that we were facing. Because at that point, ISIS-K didn't exist, but you could see the warning signs were there that a new group, more extreme group, was starting to emerge. So I started to spend a lot of time across many Middle East countries, and I learned the culture. I learned a lot of the languages, and I just learned, go back to basics, and learned a lot about the enemy that we knew we would have to face in the future. It's like anything that I do. If you're going to do something, you do it properly. Within this period of time, I also spent a six-month period with the Bedouin between Saudi Arabia and Iraq. So I lived and traveled as one of them. That was an unbelievable experience. It was fantastic because I learned how to survive in the desert. So technology is all good, but when you don't have technology, you still got to survive.
So you were traveling along with the ISIS guys?
There weren't ISIS at this time. ISIS hadn't existed, doesn't exist at that time. The Bedouin are basically not many of them are ISIS. I was just learning desert craft, like trade craft, for want of a better deal. But the information I was getting from the Bedouin, they were not happy about quite a lot of things that were going on at that time. And I was able to map out all the smuggling routes being used to bring in high-value targets, terrorists, weapons, and explosives that were crossing borders at that time. So my voluntary work I was doing ended up being a grade A source for American military intelligence, British military intelligence as well. And we were able to get a lot of information, and I enjoyed it. To me, it wasn't a job. I enjoyed this, and I knew it was making a difference at this time. Unbeknown to me at this point, some of the people who I was associating with on the American side were working for the Central Intelligence Agency and the FBI and other American intelligence agencies as well. So I actually had came on their radar in a big way. Not, I was just doing what I was doing, passing information on. One of these bits of information ended up, a operation was actually launched and 28 high-value targets were captured without a shot being fired, traveling from Syria into Iraq. That was one bit of information. So obviously, once that happened, as David Petraeus told me, one man can make a difference. So I decided to continue doing what I was doing. And then I took it very personally because a lot of my friends who were in 101st Airborne and the British military had been killed. So over the years, I've lost 28, over now, 28 of my friends were killed. So to me, this wasn't now a job. It was personal. So I didn't get angry of them being killed by, obviously, the bad guys, terrorists. It focused me. And every day I was on the ground, it helped me to focus because I knew that was one attack being stopped and that was a soldier being kept alive to return home to his family. So I get asked a lot, what was my motivation? That was my motivation. Save as many lives as you can.
I was literally just about to ask you that question. What was your motivation? That's some dangerous stuff, man. Some very dangerous stuff you're doing.
Yeah, we didn't. If I knew I was going to live this long, I would have actually took better care of myself as well. My life expectancy wasn't very good with a lot of the work I was doing. I should have been killed so many times. But
yeah,
God's always taken care of me. He's always had me back, as have the Airborne Brotherhood in America and the UK. And I'm here now. And so I use my experiences and I try and teach now as well.
Yeah, you got to kind of walk softly, blend in and walk and talk and act like them, or they know.
Oh, well, he got to the point of that the British establishment, well, a part of the British establishment or certain people in it were convinced that I had turned 100%. They said there's no way you can have the access. But unbeknown to the British establishment at that time, I'd been working with the Americans, obviously, for a long, long time. But we deemed it an unnecessary risk if we told the Brits who I worked for, what I was doing, and the successes that we were having. So we decided to keep it very quiet until an element within the British government thought about trying to charge me with being a terrorist. At that point, the American government intervened at a very high level and said, Anthony's actually not. He's actually ours. So I'm glad that your country did that.
No, I'm sure. That's an amazing, man. Your story's getting better and better. So once you... what year did you land in Afghanistan?
Well, I've been back and forth to Afghanistan from the early days, 2001 to 2002, about the same time as Iraq. As I mentioned, I used to hopscotch a lot. So I used to literally get onto a military flight from Iraq into Afghan, spend a day or so there, have a meeting, fly straight back into back again. So oh, I'm actually friends with the Massoud family as well. I used to spend a lot of time in the Panjshir. So I've been around for a long time up there in that part of the world.
Was there any part where you were just so nervous that, man, I don't know if I should keep doing this?
Honestly, no.
Because
if you think about that, it's all about positive mindset, positive attitude. I think being a young paratrooper a long time ago, that helped mold the way I am now. But also my family helped to mold the person I am now as well, because obviously I've said before, I'm a fifth generation soldier. So I was brought up with the military, brought up on an army base down the south of England when I was really young. My granddad had a massive influence on me. It was actually my granddad who taught me to shoot. And he was in North Africa, the Battle of Alamein in World War II. And he actually met my grandma when he went through Europe, and my grandma had spent time in a German concentration camp.
Mm.
So our family, we are what I would say, born and bred patriots. It's in our DNA. But it's like a lot of veterans will understand this. A lot of guys in the military, we don't think twice about running into danger or running into gunfire. The training, it kicks in. We're normal people who are not from our backgrounds or been in the services. They will run away from a danger. Because we've had the training, we actually run towards it, not in a blasé way, in a very calculated, thoughtful way, because our training kicks in. It's like when I became an embedded combat photographer, I was very good at it because I moved, walked and talked like I was still a soldier. So I knew about getting into cover. You don't hang out the window and take a photograph. You stand back from the window and you frame it. Very basic skills. My first aid skills, obviously, in Iraq and in a war zone came in handy many times. There was a lot of times I actually put the camera away as well, because there's certain photographs I think should never been taken. And I was an unusual entity being a combat photographer, because I used to check with the generals. I used to give them a copy of all my photographs and say, can you double check any of these? If you need me to pixel anything out or not release any of these photographs, let me know. And you're welcome to a copy of everything. So I had a very open relationship with the American Army. And it helped a lot. But what we take for granted, being former soldiers and veterans, our basic skills, not many people have got them in civilian street. Because I could go out in the desert for a week or 2 weeks. All they had was a Jeep, and that was it. Self-sufficient. Not many people, well, I was the only person doing that at that time. So we were able to map out so many things. We actually found some of the mass graves there. We'd actually found locations that the American military hadn't taken at that point as well. So we were able to feed that a lot of other information back as well. But it was generally just a really, really good grounded experience. I'm not blasé about it. I did put myself in harm's way many times, but it was calculated. And some of the times there was an 80% or 90% risk that I wouldn't come out of a particular task or an operation. But the reward of being able to stop terrorist attack, identify an IED factory, identify a terrorist safe house, that to me was worth the risk, because every time we took one of these locations out, it saved lives. And that was what it was about. Like I said, my motivation, save as many lives as you can, use my experience for some good, and I hope I was able to achieve that.
Oh, sounds like it. You mean you didn't want to be hanging out of the window with the flash on taking pictures?
I've seen, well, you've been there as well, brother, haven't you? You see some of these cameramen or journalists who turn up with the military, and the first thing you do is you look at the boots, you look at the kit, you look at how they interact, And a lot of the time, you just want to turn that journalist around, put them back on a plane, and send them back to the w world. So it was great when I was working with the military, because they weren't quite sure who I was, because they were like, "Yeah, that's squared away. You're like one of us." And they weren't quite sure. I said, "No, this isn't any secret. I'm an embedded photographer." They said, "Your field craft is better than some of the what they referred to as the secret squirrels at that time." So I thought, well, all right. So obviously, I was doing something right at that time as well.
Yeah, that sounds amazing. So, your time in Afghanistan, you want to go over that?
Yeah, the I was retired would you, about for about oh, 8 years or so before the evacuation all started. Like many veterans, I was watching the events unfold. It didn't sit well with me because I have a lot of friends in Afghanistan, and I could see what was coming. I started actually getting people out of Afghanistan around 2 or 3 months before the evacuation because it was easy to perceive what was going to happen. And I started getting my old satellite phone that I always keep on. It started to ring. I was getting telephone calls from Afghan generals, Afghan colonels, senior members of the former regime asking me for help. And I said, "Well, I'm not in any of this anymore. I'm out of it. You've got to go through official channels." And the responses I was getting was, "We're not getting any help. This is getting really bad." So what I was being told by people on the ground was polar opposite to what was either on the world's press, the television, or what certain government advisors were telling the public. And I got very concerned when I checked a lot of things. I don't ever take what one person tells me as being accurate. I want three individual sources that don't know each other. And if they're all telling me the same thing, it's time to dig to find out what really is happening. The collapse of the government in Afghanistan before the evacuation, it was so predictable. It was such a corrupt government that it actually fell under its own weight of corruption. Most of, not all the ministers, but most of the ministers were purely there to fill their own pockets. One of the things which absolutely astonished me was Western governments, I think we were paying for like 150,000 troops, Afghan soldiers. But it turned out there was only something in the region of like 60,000 in reality. So we'd been paying for like 15 years or more for nearly like 90,000 troops every week that didn't even exist.
Wow.
So the ring of steel around Kabul with these battalions, it wasn't going to hold for one very simple fact. These battalions didn't even exist. So it fell. It fell quickly. We predicted that. We predicted it to the point of when people were saying it's going to take 3 to 6 months for Kabul to fall, we said it will fall in 3 to 4 days. And I was right. It fell. I
Wow.
felt a responsibility because the governments had dropped the ball completely. Now, the veteran community and the service community across America and the UK, some of the work done by the veteran groups, these are veteran guys who are retired, who, like myself, the situation didn't fit well. And some of these groups moved heaven and earth, and they helped save thousands of lives. A lot of the stories haven't come out yet, but a lot of them will over time. And it's the little bands of veterans that went in there quietly and helped. They are the ones who actually stopped it being 100 times worse than what it could have been. So I would like to give a massive shout out there to all the veterans, all the supporters of the veterans, and all the guys who helped from all the different agencies. I'm not going to, I know a lot of names. I know a lot of the names of the guys who were there. I'm not going to name anybody, but they all know who they are. All I'm saying is, gentlemen, absolutely epic. You saved a lot of lives there. And I think the British and the American government needs to publicly acknowledge the help that some of these veteran groups have done and continue to do as well.
Yeah, I know some of the guys that went over as well. Pretty cool deal.
Yeah.
Yeah, they saved a lot of people. People don't even get it, don't even understand it.
Yeah, I don't think people will ever understand, because I get asked the question, why did you go back to Afghanistan? It was a danger to you, and it was an unbelievable risk for me. And my answer is, how can we not? When you receive a phone call from a family of a senior officer saying, we are stuck in Kabul, we are being hunted, and we will be executed, saying no to this particular family, to me, was not an option. And although a lot of veterans out there felt exactly the same, hence why the rest is history. We just packed our bags, dusted off our boots, and went straight back to Afghanistan.
Yeah, that's amazing. Thank God for y'all. I got some more pictures. I brought the one up a minute ago, and we said we'd go back over it. So, nope. Here it is.
What? That was, that's a cracking picture. That's actually me in Jalalabad with a member of the Taliban who was my driver at that time. And we were doing reconnaissance and meeting families that were in hiding and helping them get out of Afghanistan. Obviously, dressed as a Taliban to blend in. Obviously, black turban and me normal Afghan clothing as well. It was quite interesting because then I had a big beard as well, because we were able to move through Taliban areas and checkpoints quite easily. So we were able to use our connections there to help get a lot of people out.
Wow. Did you ever get a sense that they were on to you?
During our work side of things, no.
Wow. I don't know if I could do that, man. That's insanity.
It is a bit of an emotional... It can be emotional when you pull up at a Taliban checkpoint and you're thinking, is this going to be the day I get shot? But fortunately, it wasn't. We had good skills, good people. And we never got compromised when we were working. We did not get pulled.
You ever sit back and think, man, what was I thinking back then? Or is it just...
Hell yeah. I think you're absolutely right on that. Like, now I have a quiet night, maybe, or crack open a bottle of bourbon, and I think, wow, that was the dumbest thing I've ever done.
But it's memories, it'll last forever. And, you know, there's got to be people like you to do that kind of stuff, you know?
I'll be honest with you, to see the faces of some of the children I got through the Taliban checkpoints and out of Afghanistan, that to me, it was all worth it, because they wouldn't have got out. There's still an awful lot that goes in or goes on in Afghanistan that people are not aware of. But we saw the evidence of people being dragged out of vehicles and executed on the side of the roads. Mm. And we saw the videos of a lot of other things that were happening as well. So if we were able to get in there, again, help a few people, save lives, happy days, job done. But I wouldn't recommend it to anyone who doesn't have a very good understanding of Afghanistan.
Yeah. That's what I try to explain to people. Like, some people don't realize how good they have it in America or any other country. It's insane.
Yeah, it's very difficult to put that into words, I think, when unless people have seen there and seen how bad the situation can turn very quickly. I'm not blasé about it. We ended up being pulled in Afghanistan when I was looking at a villa to rent next to the British Embassy. So we never got compromised when we were working. I was looking at renting a house. And we got pulled off the Taliban at that point. That ended up with me spending 190 days in an underground Taliban interrogation center in Kabul. There was myself, and at that time they were pulling a lot of other Westerners. So it ended up being, I think it was five or six British nationals and one American. But that was interesting because for 2 weeks they had no idea who I was. Then after the 2 week point, like I said, it got interesting because they found out exactly who I was. Then yeah, that got a bit emotional at that point.
You want to go into it, or is it something you'd rather not tap into?
No, it's happened. It's part of the history. I'm here to tell the tale, for want of a better word. A Taliban gentleman. Now, people have got to understand that the Taliban is not a cohesive government. It's like an umbrella organization with hundreds of tribal elements within that come under the umbrella of the Taliban. Now, the Akhani network also comes under the Taliban umbrella at the moment. And the building we were kept in was a Taliban. It was the head of their intelligence, which it was NDS. It's now JDI, General Director of Intelligence. And so many tribal elements were in this building, infighting. It was unbelievable. It was like a different tribal element on each floor. Unbelievable. So obviously, I've worked a lot in the past against the Taliban. We were able to stop a lot of attacks by the Taliban onto American and British soldiers. I'm really proud of it, and I'm not going to shy away from that as well. I've written books about this. So when the Taliban found out who I was, they asked me, is this you? I said, yeah, I'm very proud of that. But that was war. We're now not at war. You're transitioning from an insurgency to a government. So that chapter is now closed. You're now a government. So you've got to run the country correctly. The gentleman who got put in charge of our interrogation could speak a little bit of English. Okay, he didn't understand the English language, but because his father was a senior member of the Taliban in Qatar, his name was, the interrogator's name was Ahmed Zaire. Youngish guy in his early 30s, not very intelligent, okay? Sometimes he acted like a petulant child. Well, me and him just didn't get on. And I know when you do your courses in resistance to interrogation, you're not meant to antagonize your interrogator. But I wasn't going to hold my tongue. He started every other day, he was ranting and raving about how bad we were. We're all dogs and evil and all that. Then he had a go at the British military, the American military, which to me was a red flag. So I actually stood up and I told him what I thought of him. On a few occasions, which didn't go down well. He wanted the code to me telephone. My answer was one word, no. And that stood for a 4 week period of time where he was basically torturing the crap out of me. He was whipping the balls of my feet. My legs were tied. I was handcuffed. Five Taliban were pinning me down. I received a lot of beatings, for want of a better word, and ends up I had like six fractured ribs, bruised kidneys, kidney infection, nerve damage down the right side of my body. So I got a hell of a beating, but I took all that, and I didn't give up my code on my phone until after the 4 week point, when I knew that everything was going to self delete. Anything of importance would be self deleted off my telephone. So all my encrypted apps and that would be blank. He knew I wasn't going to hand it over until after the 4 week point. Then when I did, he just threw the phone down and he said, "Oh no, there isn't anything on there now." I said, "Yeah, you're right. There's actually not." So that got me another kicking.
Oh,
but
wow.
One of those things, though, sometimes you've just got to stand up, be counted. I told the other guys that I was revving there, which is very important. I said, how we act in here right now, how you present yourself to the enemy, which is the Taliban, is very important. I said, your actions, your words right now will be remembered for a long time. And the guys, I don't think, understood that for a while. Then they started thinking about it. The British Foreign Office were relieved when they found out that I was getting a hard time off the Taliban, but I was giving them it back as well. They said, as soon as we found out you were giving them it straight back and all, we knew that you were okay at that point, even though we knew you'd been tortured. Now, the interesting thing that this Ahmed Zaya did was he videoed and photographed me being tortured as well. And the British Foreign Office have now backed and done a report, and there's now, and I can say this on here, there is an official Metropolitan Police SO15 war crimes investigation into the Taliban. So, and as soon as we get any major developments or updates on this, I will let you and your viewers be aware of it as well.
Wow. Was there any point that you thought you'd be killed or anything?
Honestly, yeah. I thought, you know, something, I'm just going to go out on my terms here. I'm not going to bite my tongue. I said it as it actually was. I think that was important. Did I think I was going to be taken upstairs, taken outside and shot in the back of the head? Hell yeah. There was actually a couple of occasions where I thought, this isn't going to end well for me. But I thought, at least people will know back in the world that I went out on my terms. So I walked outside, my head was held high. End of. I mean, fortunately, it didn't happen. We got threatened. We nicknamed one of the Taliban Dr. Death, because he looked like a quintessential Hollywood-type Taliban. Big black beard, black turban, black eyes. He just looked evil. He came down and told all the Westerners being held one evening that he was going to hang us all, or we were going to spend 40 years in that prison itself. So some of the guys obviously didn't handle that well. That was a bit of a diary. The way I looked at it was, you're going to do it, do it. Don't talk about it. I mean, it's one of those things, isn't it?
Good God almighty. Oh, that's a bold statement. Ooh. Now, was beatings like an everyday deal, or is it just if you lashed back out at them?
It was, there was, we had some good days in there. We had some bad days. It calmed down towards the actual end because we knew there was high-level negotiations that were going on between the Taliban and the British government and the American government as well. So near the end, we thought, we don't think we're going to be taken out here. I don't think they're going to execute us. They've got too much to actually lose. But during the first few months, it was a dark place that was. Like I said, being kept locked up nearly every day for 23 and a half hours underground, not the best thing to actually do. So a lot of it boils down to mindset as well. Your body can be there. You've got to put your mind somewhere else, though, because it's very easy for people to for everything to get on top of them. Everyone, all of us, including myself, we all had our bad days in there. We all had our good days. What baffled a lot of the other boys in there, though, they always said, you pretty much could be taken outside and executed any day. And you're very upbeat and positive. And I said, well, what's the alternative? You've got two options. You curl up in the corner and cry, or you roll up your sleeves and you crack on. Well, I'm not the kind of guy who's going to curl up in the corner and die or cry. It ain't going to happen to me. So I just rolled up my sleeves and I'm cracked on with it. And sometimes you've just got to make the best you can out of a bad situation.
You said you all were underground. Like, how deep, and was it dark, or do they have light in there, and was it hard to breathe, or?
It was under the old NDS building, which is 3x3 concrete cells, a 12-foot high wall. You don't get any natural daylight in there. The light was very low in there, very difficult to read over a period of time. We were fortunate enough to be able to get some books in there, which really helped everybody. But the light was that low, it was difficult to read. So we were literally kept out of circulation for a long period of time. Occasionally we managed to get outside, which was very rare, for maybe half an hour, if that. But that was with like six armed guards. That wasn't at the beginning. I think we went about three, I think I personally went about 3 months without actually seeing d daylight.
Oh,
After one of the interrogations where I was tortured, I was put in solitary confinement for 72 d days because
cool.
the Taliban didn't want the other prisoners to see me external injuries. So they waited 72 days before I was able to get put back in with any prisoners.
What kind of food did they feed y'all?
Rice and beans, a lot of rice and beans, which it's Afghanistan, isn't it? So, yeah.
Man, oh man. So, when you finally got out of there, did someone come to, was it a negotiation that went through to get y'all released, or did the military come and get
It
you guys?
was a negotiation. And we were taken to the actual airport, put on a flight, and we were taken to D Dubai. Because it's still quite a sensitive issue surrounding our release and how we were released and who got us released, it is still very sensitive. So I'm not actually going to speak about that on an interview. Not
No, no,
because I
no.
don't want to, it's because I've actually been asked officially not to talk about that little part of it.
No, that makes total sense. Yeah, I don't want you getting in any trouble. And you got a crazy story. I'm crazy, crazy, crazy. It's
It's
very interesting.
interesting.
There was a piece you wanted, we talked before you got on live, you wanted to share. And I think it's a good time for you to go ahead and share that piece.
Right, I've got a message to all the veterans out there and all the service personnel as well in America and obviously the Commonwealth and other Western countries. This is the time of year where we reflect a lot in England because it's coming up to Remembrance Day. So we remember our service. And we remember our fallen brothers and sisters in arms as well. Everyone's got their own way of remembering everybody, okay? We've all lost comrades in the field, okay? Now, if any veterans out there who are going through a hard time, because we all do, you don't have to be ashamed of it, we all do. I do, a lot of the other guys do. Reach out to other veterans and have a chat. Reach out to an old colleague, comrade, the guy from your unit, battalion, okay? Because they could be feeling exactly the same as you, all right? Now, we all know veterans' suicide rates very high, okay? So let's do a buddy check over the next week on everyone who we actually know, okay, lads? You'll be amazed. A quick phone call, a quick text message could make someone's day, okay? If you're feeling down, you're feeling a bit, you're not sure about things, put your boots on, put your trainers on, go for a walk in the park, do a bit of fitness, go for a swim. All right, your mindset. Get your mindset back being positive, not negative. All right, and remember, you're not alone. There's a lot of us out there. So reach out to somebody. Okay, gentlemen? And everyone who is on active service, stay safe as well. Okay? That's my message to the veteran and service personnel all over the world.
Man, you're an inspiration, man. That was beautiful what you just said. Man, your story is amazing. I'm so glad I got to get you on this morning. I know we had a little bit of technical difficulty with the email thing, but man, it was good to hear your story. It's mind blowing.
Alan, it's a pleasure to be on your show. If anyone wants to know anything else about me, full name Anthony Stephen Malone. I'm on all social media platforms. All my books are on Amazon. A lot of veterans read them and they learn a lot from them as well. And if anyone's got any questions, either contact Alan on the show or contact me directly. I've always got time for veterans. Doesn't matter what time it is or what time difference it is. Anyone wants to chat, me door's always open.
Absolutely. Another thing, I'll send me your links and I'll put them with the description on the podcast.
Awesome. Okay, Alan. Thank you, mate.
Yes, sir. Don't go anywhere. I'm going to talk to you off outside of this.